This is Nick Redding, and you're listening to PreserveCast. And today we're just thrilled to be talking with Daniela Holt-Voith, who is a founding principal of Voith and McTavish Architects, VMA. And we're going to be talking all about the work that they do, the work of a preservation architect, and how you balance contemporary and sustainability and historic all in one structure. And keep that structure still meeting its needs. But before we get there, we're gonna take a step back like we normally do and get to know the person that we're talking with. So, I think people might be curious, how do you end up becoming an architect? So, Daniela, where did you grow up, and what kind of put you on this path to this unique aspect of architecture?
So, excuse me, I grew up in the neighborhood West Mount Airy in Philadelphia. And it's a kind of beautiful, quasi, it feels suburban, although it's part of the Philadelphia city itself. But it was developed in the mid 1900s, early 1800s, and has continued to thrive to this day. It is filled with beautiful historic houses of many different styles. And then I went to a school not far away, Germantown Friends School, and that also is in an area that has many historic buildings, which really caught my eye as a youngster. How I became interested in architecture really grew out of a combination of interests in anthropology, interestingly, and fashion design. And I thought that those two interests could combine, morphing the interest in clothing into buildings so that those buildings could support human interaction. That's where I was in high school. I took an indirect path towards completing my master's degree in architecture, but it's really started from there.
So what was the indirect path? I'm curious because, well, I ask because, there are people who are listening who are like, well, I've kind of gone down this road. I can't become an architect, or I'm at this point in my career and I can't do that. And I think one of the things that we learn through these interviews is that there's rarely a direct path. I mean, every once in a while we find somebody who's like, I knew I had to be an archaeologist, but or whatever it might be, but it's not as common as I think people think it is.
That's so true. And when you're a developing personality and a developing intellect, you really don't know, right? And I went to Bryn Mawr College that did not have an architecture program, but it had a newly formed major in the history of cities, the history of architecture. So I signed up for that. And then I also took some design classes at the University of Pennsylvania. Then, in the middle of my college career, I, for some reason, landed an amazing job at a company called the Architects Collaborative, which was located then in Cambridge, doesn't exist anymore. But I was so fascinated by this experience that I opted to take a year off of college and continue working there, trying to make up my mind whether I wanted to go back and complete my liberal arts degree or go directly into architecture. At the end of that year and 3 months or so, I said, you know what? Most of these people that I'm talking to here have never read great literature, don't know how to speak foreign languages. They don't have the well-rounded education that Bryn Mawr was really offering. So I went running back to Bryn Mawr. Then when I graduated, I worked for another architect. Then I got into Yale, which is fantastic for me. It was my first choice. And I worked there for studying there for a year and a half. And then again, I took a year off. So I took that year off and worked for another architect. But at every juncture, I was making a set of decisions that say, is this narrowing my opportunities or is it broadening my opportunities? And I really was interested in academics, so teaching. I was interested in writing some. I was interested in design. And so I kept saying to myself, well, I finished this degree, I could do any of these. And what's funny is, at this point in my career, I'm doing all three. So I've been teaching for decades, and I love that. And it actually influences my work because it is focused on educational institutions. And I'm doing some writing, and obviously we're designing buildings. So that's what I mean by not direct.
Yeah, no, I love it. I think it's really interesting. Another thing I wanted to pick up on that you mentioned is very early on when you were given that first answer, you talked about the human interaction and it kind of spurred
Yes.
by an interest in fashion and things like that. I'm curious if you think that your interest in historic architecture is a result of that, because throughout the 20th century, there's this push and pull between the human interaction with buildings and sort of these buildings that are out of scale with humanity. They can be very just thinking about sort of like brutalist architecture, and that has a place in the historic sort of pantheon, but it also, the big criticism against it is that it is out of scale with humanity, and that you walk by a brutalist structure that is just a giant block long concrete block, and it's hard to interact with
I
that.
know,
I'm
yes.
curious if that is what drew you to historic architecture, or what was it about historic architecture? Because, not every architect gets involved in historic architecture, but you did.
Yes, and I want to clarify that we do work that is strictly preservation-oriented, rehabilitation. We also do new construction,
Sure.
and we do new buildings that are both historicist and more contemporary. But you're absolutely right, that interest in humanism, the interest in scale, context, the interest in detail, relatability, all of those things are aspects of architecture that historic architecture, whether it was architect designed or just more a design build sort of project out of a really skilled craftsman. People were thinking about those issues for centuries. And so even in our more contemporary work, we're still thinking about scale, proportion, detail. What do you see at your eye level? What's the tactile experience? What's the haptic experience? So that haptic is how your body responds to a particular space. So anybody that has gone into an amazing cathedral has a sense of being uplifted and maybe spiritually impacted. It's a visceral reaction.
Yeah.
I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think the most recent experience I had like that was walking back to Philadelphia. It wasn't by design to mention this, but walking into the 30th Street station coming
Oh my
up,
goodness.
from the depths, the catacombs of the station, and then you were just presented with this amazing structure. And I was
Exactly.
with somebody else, and I said, if you walk into a building like this and you're not impressed, like something's probably wrong with you. Like you, it's hard not to be taken away and to sort of be moved by that experience when you walk into that space. So
One of
that's
my
definitely
favorite
a
public spaces in
haptic environment.
Philadelphia.
Yeah, a positive haptic environment. So you're with the Architects Collaborative, which I have heard of and heard about some of their work. But then you are involved in VMA now, Voith and McTavish Architects. Tell us a little bit about that firm, when it was founded, and your role in its inception.
Right. So Voith McTavish was started in 1988. It was an outgrowth of a previous partnership that I had formed. And it was just me and Cameron McTavish. And actually we were working out of the front room of my house. Luckily, Cameron lived a block down from me, so it was an easy commute for him and an even easier one for me. And we started really doing residential work, and this is how we cut our teeth in learning how to respond gracefully to existing historic buildings, because many of our first commissions were additions and expansions to beautiful historic houses in Philadelphia. And our clients were interested in making their house bigger, but not necessarily a completely different kind of structure. So they were interested in making their house feel as if it had always been slightly larger. So we quickly learned how to respond to buildings that were built out of masonry, or if they were clapboard, or if they were, more shingle style or more Georgian. So it was a very flexible and I don't know if it was intuitive, but a studied response to the historic context that we were working within. And that skill and mindset was, at the time when we were initially practicing, very radical, because as you mentioned, modernism, strict modernism, held sway. And doing postmodernist work was something that didn't appeal to me at all, because it felt too ironic, or, I don't know, just it was almost like a joke on architecture in some sense. And Cameron and I were much more interested in responding directly to the materiality and the original architecture of the buildings we were working with. So we were seen as a radical bad boys in some sense at that point. Why you sort of fringe? And over the years, there's a much bigger movement now in practicing that way, I think slightly spurred by an organization called the Institute of Classical Architecture and Art, and other like-minded designers who are interested in either working with historic buildings or creating a sense of history from scratch. And, the United States was a, in some sense, a blank slate for Western style building. It was inhabited by people who were, I think, much more in tune to the environment and the earth. They weren't building permanent structures. And when, the European influence comes over and they're trying to recreate home, they're really literally recreating a memory. And we're a 300-year-old country, thereabouts, and we're still trying to create environments that may feel like, something that's thousands of years old in Europe. So
It's interesting that you point out the Institute. That would be a good future PreserveCast episode to talk to somebody with them. But what the sort of common sense thing that occurs to me too that we see in preservation is that, and we talk about it in relationship to smart growth and planning, is that communities seemingly, everyone is in, what I'm trying to say is it seems like many are in love with historic communities, whether it be Philadelphia, whether it be, here, Oxford, Maryland, or Easton, or Frederick, or, places
yes.
here in our state. And yet we still build the things that people don't love, because perhaps it's easier, or it's simpler, or it goes together faster. But, I've said to planners before, if you want to build communities that people love, perhaps you should just study the ones that people love.
Yes, and many firms do,
Yes.
Hart Howerton, I think Elizabeth Plater-Zyberg and her husband Andres Duaney were re really at the forefront of planned communities that really drew from historical concepts. So there are, in the whole push of new urbanism is exactly that. But yes, developers are developers, and they're interested in lowest first cost, a high return, rather than an institutional outlook, which is we're building something for the centuries. And that in part is why we love working for institutions, because they really can invest in building quality and more than being a profit-driven thing. So they're looking at long-term costs as opposed to short-term costs.
So you've worked on, a number of different projects, and we could talk about all of these. And I think what's valuable for the listening audience is that this kind of gives us an eye into the world of the architect. So now we kind of have a sense for your worldview, the kind of architecture and the projects that you've worked on, and what interests you, the scale and the style. But every project is different. So I thought maybe we would tease out a specific one and talk about how you approach it and how it all kind of comes together. And since PreserveCast is powered by Preservation Maryland and we're based out of Maryland, we record this here in Maryland, we thought we would talk about a project in the town of Oxford, Maryland, which is a charming little place, and we'll let you describe it. But it's a community center that you worked on there. So why don't you kind of paint the picture for not only what is Oxford, but what is this building that you worked on?
Thank you. The Oxford evidently was, a seaside or oceanside community that was not accessible by land until the 1960s, when a bridge was built over the Bay Bridge. And it's a very small, beautiful, historic community. My business partner, Cameron McTavish, is a longtime interest in sailing, and he decided to dock his boat, his sailing vessel, in Oxford. And he started driving down to Oxford from Philadelphia. And I had a nice conversation with him a couple days ago about this. He said that every time he drove into Oxford, he'd pass this building, and which is now the Oxford Community Center. And he said, "I always gave that building a second look. It was well proportioned. It had a sophistication about it that he found really appealing." And so he's innately drawn, in some sense, to this building. A few years later, he and his wife Michelle actually bought a house in Oxford, a charming, charming house, and he's now retired there. And because of his involvement with the community, he was asked to come and look at the structure and figure out whether or not drawings for some ADA restrooms made sense. And so he said, sure. And Cameron, being Cameron, gets inside the building, and then he's immediately interested, and he starts climbing up ladders and staircases, and he somehow got into the high reaches of the building, because there had been a drop ceiling put in, I think, essentially the 1960s. And so there's this incredible space above the drop ceiling. And he says to the person he was with, "You have to come up here and see this," right? And he, from the inside, he could see the outlines of three enormous lunette windows. They had been covered over in aluminum siding, and he could see these incredible diagonal trusses. And he gets down out of that space and starts talking with the community and the people who were inhabiting this building, which is the Oxford Community Center, saying, "You really need to, give some love to this building, rehabilitate it." And sort of the idea took hold, and they got inspired and excited. Cameron did some initial drawings and did some estimates. And then at the time, there is this grant opportunity. There are actually two grants that we went for. One was the Sustainable Communities Tax Credit, and the other was an additional bonus for doing an environmentally responsible building, so achieving LEED Gold. And it was a substantial amount. So the initial construction cost was about $2.5 million. And ultimately, the community center received a check for $625,000 of that. So it was a much smaller lift than that, 2.5, which is a huge amount of money for a small community. But the result is that they made the building completely ADA accessible. The lunette windows were restored, built in kind, so that the kind of industrial look of the original was matched. The trusses were exposed, and the building, I should say, I should back up and say that the building was originally a school. It had six classrooms, and the center space was what we call a gym, a cafetorium. So a bunch of,
I went to one of those
yeah,
schools
right?
that
A
had that.
lot of schools had a gym, a cafetorium. One classroom per grade. It was an elementary school, so six classrooms. And it's a very flexible plan, it turns out. So the three classrooms are now been repurposed into a kitchen, a reception room, some classrooms. And now the theater aspect of that central space has been brought back to life, so it has a performance component. And there are things that are happening in the community center every day that bring life to the community, whether it's art or music or performance or a political meeting. There's all sorts of things that happen in that space. So it has literally brought more life to Oxford. The original architect was Henry Powell Hopkins, and the building was built in the 1928. And Henry Powell Hopkins was a very fine kind of regional classical architect. He was educated at Columbia University. And he was responsible for many of the fine buildings in Maryland. And somehow he made it to Oxford. He was brought over to Oxford to design this building. And that's probably why Cameron was so attracted to the building to start with, because he could tell and he responded to the classical proportions and the really kind of weightiness of the structure and the innovative aspects of the structure as well. So this building, was successful in getting those tax credits, which was an enormous boon. It also won a Philadelphia Merit Award from the American Institute of Architects, and it did achieve that LEED Gold certification. So the combination of preservation and sustainability is something that's very near and dear to our preservation studio. The strategies that we used to make the building more sustainable was to power the building for heating and cooling through a geothermal field. So it's renewable energy. There's on-site water retention. So there's, the handling of stormwater and that sort of thing is really handled in a nice, sophisticated way with rain gardens. That's something that you see more and more with development. The materials that we use, linoleum flooring, for example, one of the greenest flooring materials available, which I learned the other day was developed in the 1880s. Is that amazing?
I would believe it. And
We're still using it today.
it's linseed oil, right? I mean, it's so
Yeah,
it's
it's linseed
flax.
oil and flax seed and some cork, pressed into jute. So those are the things that kind of went into our thinking process for the building.
Let me ask you this. For somebody listening who is like, okay, well, that's a really beautiful place and a cool building, and I actually didn't realize that it was Hopkins. He is sort of prolific in Maryland. His
Yes.
fingerprints are all over the place. But someone, let's say someone in, Iowa has a mundane school building or something like this that they want to jump into. If they're going to be talking to an architect, what are the kind of questions or what are the things that they should be thinking about when they're talking to prospective architects? Like, if they're going to ask, if people are coming to you, what's like a well-informed client look like? Because I know that there's well-informed clients, and then there's also, well, you probably have a lot of different names for them, but there's other clients who perhaps want to do the design work, or they're too involved in different aspects. But what is it that, I think it, from your perspective, sitting across the table of the architect, that you want to know what kind of questions or answers are you looking for? What is a well-informed person who is looking to do a project like this? What should they be thinking about?
Right. So, most of the work that we do is for institutions, and institutions do function a bit like people. They have their own characteristics and their own strengths and weaknesses. So for us, a well-informed client is one that clearly understands the goals that they wish to achieve. They have a notion of their schedule, and they should have a notion of their ability to fund a project. Now, they might not have a full idea of how much a project may cost, but and I would say it's important not to have a fixed idea of the project budget until the work has been done to figure out what the building is capable of handling, whether or not an addition has to be made, what the condition of the building is, et cetera. And then look at a realistic combination of program and an achievable budget, right? So there's certain flexibility of mind that a client needs to have in order to not get their hopes and dreams stuck on an unrealistic budget or a scope that can't be achieved. We find ourselves on lists to compete for projects often, in which the variety of client of architect type is so broad that we understand that the client has no actual idea of what they're looking for in an architect. So we don't compete with firms that are really catering to developers. They're small, very small firms. They're very large firms. They're firms that have a lot of in-house expertise versus not. So who we're competing against often tells us a lot about the client and whether or not the client's sophisticated or not.
Is there
But in any case,
still?
we're looking for somebody who's When we're looking for a client, we're looking for a client that is excited about what they're doing, passionate about it in some ways, and has done enough strategic thinking, that they understand where they're going with this project.
And then two follow-ups to that. Can an architect assist with that kind of strategic thinking and much more nuts and bolts? Is there still sort of a basic rule or a percentage that you should expect to spend on architecture as a component of the broader project? Or is that
Oh,
kind of
okay.
out
So,
the, yeah.
the scope of our services and our fees. So, what we like to do is to, in the programming phase. So that's the development of the spaces and the square footages and the adjacencies, right? Developing what we call an architectural program. We meet with our clients, and there's usually a steering committee, and then there may be various smaller interest groups. So, at Oxford, we might have been talking to the art people or the event people. right? And each of those have slightly different takes on what is needed out of a building. And we can help with questions like, well, what's really working well for you? What do you want to keep? And what do you want to let go of? And what's your aspiration? So that level of strategic thinking we can help with as the needs relate to physical plant. What we shouldn't be involved with is where are the institutions going as a whole? Do you want to grow? Do you want to, push a particular agenda? Do you want to, there's all sorts of broader questions, and those questions should be well understood before a building project is undertaken. The second aspect of your question, the one about fees, is difficult to answer because our fees always respond to a particular project and how complicated it is, what array of other consultants we need, sub-consultants we need. We may need a civil engineer, a structural engineer, a materials conservation firm, a painting restoration, company. There, a lighting consultant, an acoustic consultant. If you don't need all of those, then the fees are going to be less. If you do need all of those, then the fee's going to be more. Our fees tend to be comprehensive in terms of the overall scope. I would say that as a percentage, there's a range that we typically see, maybe from 8 to 15%. That's a big range, but think about that.
No, that sounds that's I think that's really helpful for people listening who maybe aren't that familiar with architecture. I think it's great to kind of go from, what we did here today was theory to project to, okay, I want to do this. What should I be thinking about if I'm going to hire one? Because I think it's intimidating if you're not used to it. It's a profession that seems in some ways sort of magical, mystical, like the you take your information to them and then they come back with this amazing plan. So there's a lot of mystery built into it. And I think one of the things that we like to do is kind of help people think through how to use this, because using an architect is critical for a preservation project. I was just with geez, this is sounding like the Philadelphia episode, but I was just meeting with our partners at the Partners for Sacred Places
Oh, they're
in
wonderful
Philadelphia.
people.
Yeah,
Yes.
and we've had Bob on the podcast before, the founder. And one of the things they say is you have to use an architect if you're going to do a project, and they strongly encourage churches and any religious institution, be it a synagogue or a mosque, to think about making sure you have funding in place so that you have an architect to guide you along. So architecture is critical to preservation. That's one of the messages we're trying to get across today. And the folks at VMA are a great team that does that kind of work. Speaking of that kind of work, what are you working on now? Anything interesting that people would be familiar with or be excited about?
Well, in terms of preservation, we're working on a number of buildings at Catholic University. My business partner, John Kluver, actually heads up our preservation studio. And he has been working with Catholic on issues surrounding window replacement, masonry restoration, accessibility. There's a particular set of problems taking a building that was designed originally with no air conditioning and then having to air condition it. And John is fascinated by the sustainability aspects of preservation, and what has to be done to the building envelope to preserve the building envelope when the humidity, is going in the opposite direction in some sense, right? Air conditioning sucks the humidity out of the air, and then that means that water wants to come through the walls in ways that it was not designed to do. We always say that the most sustainable building is using what you have, using the embodied energy of an existing building. And then we say, that you need to really make sure that what you're designing is going to fit the needs, not overfit the needs. So we are interested in right sizing, right? And then we're interested in all the technical issues that have to do with building envelope and, as I just described. And more than that, there's kind of the lovability of a historic building, which is what you started talking about at the beginning of this podcast. We often say that if a building is lovable, it will be loved and it will be preserved and it will be restored as it needs to as time goes forward. So we seek to design in ways that pull on people's emotions, and hopefully people find these buildings inspiring and comfortable and uplifting to live and work in.
Yeah, we need a lovability scale for historic structures. We'll
Yes,
have to
yes.
determine one, how high of a lovability scale, because I can think of a lot of buildings that I love, and then there's a lot of buildings where I'm like, I guess I just put up with
Right.
it.
Right.
So yeah, that's fascinating, and I think it's the quirk, it's the charm, and it's that human scale, which is where we started. So the most difficult question, it's like asking your parent their favorite child. Do you have a favorite historic place?
Oh my goodness. I mean, I'm a traveler of the world. I've been to over 60 countries.
Wow.
And I'm still going, right? So it is really hard for me to pick a particular spot. I
You could
just
say
got back to
most recent favorite
most
historic
recent, well,
place.
I was just in Croatia and Milan last week. And Milan is a place I've gone back to over and over and over again. And I love it in part because it's similar to Philadelphia in some ways. It's a very hidden city. Like Philadelphia's charms don't necessarily come to the fore unless you live there and you know it and you know where to go. And Milan seems on the outside like a very hard place, but there's so much greenery and excitement on the insides of those large building blocks because there are gardens and courtyards and things like that that reveal themselves as you gain access to them. So, but do I love Milan more than Paris or London? Or I was just in Seoul and there's amazing historic buildings in Korea. I mean, it's really hard to choose. And I think in general, it's an attitude to be receptive to what people have done, across the centuries to accommodate different cultures and lifestyles and values that it excites me and gets me up every morning and makes me want to go and see more and experience more.
I think that what you just said there, we could put that if it would fit on a bumper sticker, we put it on one. That's a perfect way to end the conversation because that's what inspires you, that's what keeps you going. And that is a great way of kind of looking at the world and looking at architecture is, what came before and the value that people in the past placed on things and how we continue to care for and love those places on that lovability scale. So,
Absolutely, Nick.
Daniela, it's been such a wonderful conversation, so inspiring and interesting to hear about what your firm has been working on over at VMA. And look forward to having you back when you have another project to talk about.
Absolutely, Nick. Thank you so much for having me on your podcast. I really have enjoyed this.
Wonderful. Thank you.